Warning: The Savage Nation contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised. And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation, home of borders, language, culture. And here he is, Michael Savage.
It is the Savage Nation Friday edition, open mic to mic. Phone number 855-400-7282 on any topic that tickles your fancy. I can't guarantee that you'll get through the call screener, but we'll give you a shot. 855-400-SAVAGE. Now, here's what I'm going to do. I prepared all day to talk about the difference between a statesman and a politician, meaning, let us say, Mandela versus Obama. Because there is a difference. And I was going to compare the two, the difference between a statesman and a politician. And we may do that later. I have so much wonderful preparation on that. And then I thought, you know, it's Friday night. I don't know if people care anymore. The economy seems to be selectively booming. I know that that's a controversial statement, and the conservative diehards are saying things have never been worse, the sky is falling. And yet I look around, it seems like we're living in boom times again. I know, I say unemployment's down, jobs are up, but then you say there's 10 million, 11 million people on the disability fraud, then they're fudging the numbers. Yet the stores are jammed in San Francisco. You can't get in. People are beating each other with umbrellas. You can't get in restaurants. So it's the best of times and the worst of times. It depends upon where you live and how you're living. Rents. Where's the money coming from for the rentals in San Francisco? No one can afford it. Where does the money come from? If we're in such a depression, which the Republicans want to consider, we're in the worst recession in history. No, we're not. No, we're not. It's not the worst in history. Yes, it's printed money. Yes, no one knows where it's going to end, but I didn't want to talk about that. Here's what I want to talk about. Since Obama eliminated the filibuster just 2 weeks ago, I will filibuster on this show tonight for a congressional investigation into the Navy SEAL deaths on that old Chinook helicopter back in 2009. Remember, I dedicated a novel to that called A Time for War, and nothing happened. People bought the book. I've had the parents of the dead SEALs on the show. And I'm sick to my heart that so many SEALs could die in one crash, and there's not been, A, an outcry by the American people, and B, no congressional investigation as to who in the White House or the Defense Department put all of those 38 SEALs on that old helicopter and sent them to their fiery death. So I begin my filibuster tonight. I've read you the opening before about them on the helicopter and it crashes. And now we go to chapter one because it's set in the Bay Area, and many of you listen to me in the Bay Area. Tell me what you think about this. It's my novel, A Time for War, Sausalito, California, headline, killing all 38 Navy SEALs on board. Jack Samuel Hatfield slapped off the alarm on his clock radio. The words hadn't quite registered as he blinked to clear his vision, trying to make out the luminous red numbers. He pushed the black hair from his high, strong forehead, dragged a hand across tired eyes. "You're late, champ," he smiled as Eddie bounded toward him from the foot of the queen-sized bed. The four-year-old gray poodle, all tongue and forepaws and big brown eyes, usually woke him up a minute or two before the 6 a.m. alarm. Jack dug his fingers behind the dog's ears, and Eddie drew back his head and jerked approvingly. Jack ended their morning ritual by pulling a well-worn chew toy from the drawer of his night table and flinging the toy to the floor. Eddie followed, landing on the rubber stake with a single mighty leap and a whimpering squeak from the stake. "Lie back and think of England," Jack told the chew toy. Then he groaned. He hadn't been awake 2 minutes, and already England was back on his mind. Eddie had landed on the rubber stake like the full weight of Britain's blinkered bureaucracy had landed on Jack, who was still banned by the British Home Office from entering the United Kingdom, along with terrorists and criminals. Normally, it never crossed his mind, but he had a lead for a story he was writing on the smuggling of illegal Chinese medicines. The lead was in London, and London was off limits. Jack stood up, his body automatically adjusting to the gentle sway of the 40-ton Sea Rider. The cast-off bedsheet buried Eddie, who pulled his toy to safety and continued gnawing. Jack Hatfield, Jack thought, the defrocked talk show host and the last truly independent journalist in America, hounded by the illiberal left and defamed worldwide, needs coffee. But he still headed to his office video editing station in the converted lower deck stateroom before he made it to the kitchen. He clicked on the radio and started going through his email. Prince William and the lovely Princess Kate will be touring. He turned off the radio. They probably spend 60 seconds on the Navy SEALs, he muttered, but they'll spend the full 5 minutes on the vacation plans of royalty. Every day, he wondered, was his profession dead now? How about now? News channels were afraid to report anything that their audiences might whine about, never mind topics that could scare them. Changing people's minds was serious, vital business, and nobody had the guts to do it anymore. Jack had received regular death threats when he was hosting his cable news talk show, Truth Tellers, but they had never discouraged him. Instead, it had taken all the resources of a giant to swat Jack down back when he posed one simple rhetorical question to the panel on his former TV show. Quote, how would you feel if Muslim extremists got hold of a nuclear weapon? Within hours, MediaWire, the leftist radical watchdog group founded and funded by reclusive Austrian-born billionaire Lawrence Soren, had organized a smear campaign. They had been looking for a hook on which to hang Jack like a slaughtered bull. He was labeled an Islamophobe, and the liberals gleefully piled on with the kind of manic indignation only aging hippies and ignorant youth could muster. By the time Soren was done, Truth Tellers had not only lost half of its sponsors, but Jack was out of his job, and he was barred from the United Kingdom due to his, quote, radical and provocative statements, close quote, that were deemed a threat to public security. Eddie trotted into the office, the chew toy in his mouth. He laid down and sank his teeth into it. Now Jack was freelance, but San Francisco had been quiet for weeks. The most promising story was the smuggling. His phone rang. The caller ID said it was Max. I don't care if it's good or bad, he said into the phone, as long as it's news. It's one of yours, she said it, so it's news. Maxine Cole, 27 years old, was a triathlete of Somali descent who'd moved to the United States when she was a kid. She'd spent her teens in the projects, but got herself out by teaching herself how to shoot network-quality video. She'd managed to keep her street sense and her fearlessness, too, and the result was a co-worker who could keep up with Jack in any situation, no matter how dangerous. The arrest of the state senator's son, he asked her? Yes, she said, I read your report. Jack had sent it to her for a few tweaks and some feedback. Listen, Jack, she continued, for 99.99% of the world, this report is going to be exactly what we expect from you, but I have to say this, I think you're dialing it in, you're not fully into it. Jack was silent for a minute. Then he said, you're right. Just a tiny bit, like I said, no one except me is going to notice, but I didn't feel right not saying something to you. It's just that it's not the smuggling story, she asked. Exactly. It's a rich kid getting arrested for drugs. Meanwhile, in China, there are farms where bears are caged, lying on their backs with no room to move, with tubes in their abdomens to collect bile for so-called medicines. Some of the bears have actually committed suicide by starving themselves to death, and multiple smuggling operations are carrying the bear bile along with body parts from tigers and other endangered animals out of China to the rest of the world. I covered it on Truth Tellers until the networks got too scared of offending their Chinese investors. Now I have a chance to break the story again, and I can't. She said, you have contacts in London. You can ask them to follow up on it, can't you? Yeah, but it's not the same. He didn't reply. She knew him well. It wasn't that he didn't trust his contacts to do a good job. He simply wanted to be the one doing it. They said goodbye and hung up. San Francisco, California. Standing just over 5 feet tall and slight as a snow pea, as her father put it, there was nonetheless something about 26-year-old Maggie Yu that commanded the aisles of the Yu Market on Clay Street. It was partly her posture, erect and centered, creating a straight line from the top of her head to her feet. It was partly the serenity of her expression, her dark eyes never seeming to blink, her lips together in a relaxed line, her round face untroubled with lines or color other than the natural blush of her cheeks. And it was partly the unwavering focus she brought to the task at hand. I'm reading from A Time for War by Michael Savage. It's a filibuster on my part until Congress holds an investigation of who put all those SEALs on that single helicopter. There's never been an investigation. Maggie finished checking the inventory her father had brought in before dawn. Fish, vegetables, beverages, candy. Taking a last look around, the young woman placed the clipboard on its hook beneath the counter. She removed the apron. The century-old brass bell tinkled above the door. Maggie smiled as she welcomed the first customer, Mrs. Chan. The smile was sincere. She was surrounded by love. One of the love objects was her father, Johnny Yu, who had opened the grocery store in 1986, the year before Maggie was born. It was originally going to be named the Hung Pu Market for the river where he used to sit as a boy growing up in Shanghai, his eyes on the ships that used to come and go, one of which a freighter eventually took him to his new home with his new bride. But Anita Yu did not want to be reminded of their old life. She insisted he name the grocery for his ancestors, but also for himself and Yu descendants. He agreed that that was a better idea. I then described the store itself, which I will skip. And then the third thing Maggie loved was the Chinese population of San Francisco. Today, the community had over 100,000 citizens nestled between the financial district and Nob Hill. The citizens were vibrant and resilient, hardworking men and women devoted to their families, their neighborhood, and their nation. They were patriots with affection for their ancestral land, but with a fierce love for their current home. But, sadly, there were also some, the fewest in number and certainly the least in moral character, who exhibited the kind of selfish ambition that tore the community apart a century before in a series of wars fought to control criminal activity. These people troubled Maggie. She saw them every day when they came into the store, usually young men, usually buying cigarettes, chips, or soda. They always looked out the door while they stood at the counter. There was something itchy about them, restless, eyes roving, shoulders rolling. They just seemed ready to take, not from her or her father. Shoplifting was too small. Besides, the locals knew she was ready for them, and there were security cameras behind the counter. These misfits preferred to steal cars or electronics outside the community so as not to embarrass family. They sold drugs or laundered currency to those who were not Chinese, until today. The bell jangled again. A Chinese man entered the store as Mrs. Chan was leaving. He was in his early 30s, and she had not seen him emerge from the black SUV double parked outside, but there was no doubt it was his. The smoky windows were like his smoky sunglasses, secretive, out of place. He removed the glasses as he approached. He wore soft tan gloves. It wasn't cold enough for that, not even on a chilly winter morning. The man was sharp, from the even lines of his buzz cut to the strong set of his square jaw to the rigid creases in his tan suit. He was short, only about 5'6". But the way he stood when he reached the counter, with his shoulders drawn back and his feet close together, made him seem taller. "I would see the owner of the shop, please," he said, glancing about the store. "My father is not here. How may I help you, mister?" "Lee," the man regarded her, his eyes very still. "You can help by telling your father I wish to speak with him." Maggie did not believe his name was Lee. That was the equivalent of Smith or Jones in America. His schooled, non-colloquial English reinforced the woman's impression that he was not from around here. She guessed he was a Chinese national. His severe bearing, his neutral identity with personal nuance drilled away, suggested a military background. And he obviously wasn't here to sell her father anything. He wasn't carrying a tablet, a briefcase, or even a cell phone. Protection, she wondered? That was the enterprise of local thugs who knew better than to come here. Besides, the shop was on a block of mom-and-pop stores and restaurants. Shakedown money from all of them wouldn't pay for a week's worth of gas in this Escalade. "Dad will be here in about 3 hours, Maggie told him. "If you want to come back, my business cannot wait. I'm afraid it will have to." The man had barely moved since approaching the counter. Now he took a step forward. Several candy bars fell as he pressed against the child-high shelves in front of him. When he spoke, his voice was soft but firm. "Call him, please." Maggie continued to smile. This man, these men, whatever they wanted, had been thrust on them, something urgent. "There are two things I can do for you," Maggie said, raising her voice. "I can give my father a message, or I can sell you something. Which would you like, Mr. Lee?" Lee smiled faintly. It was barely noticeable, but Maggie saw it. She knew he was about to grab her. She knew it from her 22 years as a fighter. The fourth thing Maggie loved was a kung fu. She had been training since she was 4 years old, first with their neighbor who held a black belt in a Nabi Su form, then at a martial arts school that practiced Jeet Kune Do, the hybrid style developed by Bruce Lee. She had earned a black belt before she turned 14. The essence of both styles is that energy comes from the ground, from the air, from the world around the martial artist, who gathers it in his center and drives it forward. The attack often comes in a variety of animal styles, whose offense and defense were studied and adapted by the ancient Chinese. In the split second that the man smiled, Maggie planned her attack. She knew she had the size advantage. In kung fu, smaller is faster. She knew she had the counter to work with, to use as a barrier, or maybe she could double him over on it. And she knew that she had quiet skills while he had pride and arrogance, the worst hobbles a person could have in a fight. Just then her father appeared from the back of the store. "Everything okay, Maggie?" he asked. "Not really, father," she said. "The man wanted to speak to you." "Do I want to speak with him?" "I don't think so," Maggie said. Johnny fixed steady, unrelenting eyes on the man. "I don't believe you are welcome here." The would-be attacker, denuded of all pride, took one look at Johnny and the two mourners. Maggie could see him calculating the odds in his head. He turned and hurried out of the store, the doorbell jingling on the way out. The street sounds were momentarily louder, and the door slammed. There was a moment of silence. I'll be back in a moment to read from A Time for War as a filibuster against the Obama administration until they decide to hold a congressional investigation into the Navy SEAL deaths and an old Chinook helicopter. I'm Michael Savage. I'll be right back.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage.
So let me tell you why I'm reading this tonight. It's called A Time for War. It's a novel that came out last year. It's in paperback now. I wrote it. And it starts with the Navy SEAL helicopter going down in Afghanistan and all the SEALs dying. Remember, 38 SEALs were sent to their death in Afghanistan, and there's never been an investigation of who put them on that old Chinook helicopter. Not one investigation, because there's somebody covering up who did this. We don't know whether it was from the White House or the Defense Department. We don't know whether the SEALs were killed by an Afghani soldier aboard. Somebody set them up for death. Remember, this is the largest death of Navy SEALs in their history of their unit, all under Obama, and it's been swept under the rug. So I wrote a novel, a thriller, from the New York Times best-selling author, Abuse of Power, and radio host of The Savage Nation, comes a powerful new thriller. Let me read you the summary. A Chinook helicopter carrying a squad of Navy SEALs suddenly plummets to earth in Afghanistan. A car driven by FBI agents tailing a suspicious vehicle is mysteriously rendered immobile in San Francisco. The body of a Chinese agent is found floating miles from the Golden Gate Bridge after being fed to sharks. The U.S. is under secret attack, and only Jack Hatfield, a popular TV host, hounded from his position by left-wing forces in the media for speaking the truth, suspects the danger of this lethal conspiracy. With the help of the young Dover Griffith, an idealistic young woman staffer at the Office of Naval Intelligence, Hatfield pursues a trail leading to a billionaire American electronics entrepreneur who has sold out his own country with the help of officials at the highest level of the American government. Sound good? I think it's good. I think I'll read you the sex scene. Maybe you'll listen then. Shall I get salacious? I mean, that's the world we're living in.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-7282. Savage.
I may get back to some of the news a little later. I don't know. I'm not in the mood for it. I mean, the Mandela story is basically over, except amongst politicians who are trying to capitalize on the man's statesmanship. They're all politicians, not statesmen. They're going to draw cover by going to the funeral. We know this. It's going to be 10 days of hiding behind his statesmanship and pretending that they're in the same category. But I don't want to do it. I'm just not in the mood. It's a Friday night. It's raining out here in the Bay Area. Yeah, we're on the verge of, the Christmas holidays. I listen to people. Their minds are on shopping, going on vacation, as you would be if you're a normal person. They don't care really much about politics. You may think that this is all a political show, but you're wrong. Remember, I made my reputation through news, views, and reviews, so don't expect me to sit here and hammer day and night about Obama. I'm not going to do it. But tonight is a political show. Even though I'm reading from A Time for War, I'm doing it for a political reason. I want an investigation. In a true democracy, there would be an investigation to see who in the Defense Department, who in the executive branch, put those SEALs on that old helicopter and sent them to their fiery death. Someone did this. It's unheard of. It's unheard of that the military itself is not screaming for this. Why are the SEALs themselves not saying anything? So before I go back to reading from my novel, I want to ask you a question. Who do you think, or why do you think, rather, the Navy SEALs were put on that helicopter and sent to their death? Ron on KSFO. Go ahead, please. You're the first up.
Hey, Mike. The reason why they were killed is to shut them up. It's very obvious to me that Osama bin Laden was not killed by SEAL Team 6, and these guys took the fall, took the rap for it, and they were killed to shut them up. Or, sir, they went deep black. It's a fake death thing, and they're deep black. But if they really did die...
Well, wait. That's absurd. The parents of the dead have been on the show. They're not deep black. They're gone. Right. The parents have been on this show screaming to the rooftops trying to get an investigation. So that theory is wrong.
Well, thank you so much for discussing it. I can't believe that you of all people are doing it. I'm so grateful to you for that. But for sure, they were killed because I was...
All right, well, something is wrong. It stinks to high heaven. It happened to SEAL Team 6 shortly after they allegedly killed Osama bin Laden. They were sent on a false flag mission, and they were all killed. And there's not been any congressional investigation. I'm demanding one. I'm only a citizen. So let me pick up in my story. So this Chinese guy comes into a Chinese grocery in San Francisco. He doesn't get what he wants. He leaves embarrassed. And so he goes back into the car, and the man says to him, "These are all Chinese nationals. You have embarrassed us," said the man. And he says, "You're not in a position to judge me." And he says, "More importantly," the other man cut him off, "you have embarrassed yourself." The man says, "I didn't want to cause a scene." The other man punched him on his right cheekbone with the full force of his body behind it. There was a dull, ugly snap below the cell leader's temple. "You have no right to strike your leader," he whimpered. "You are no longer the leader," said the other man. The man with the broken jaw sat back with full realization of what that meant and what would be coming next. Quickly, he reached for the door handle of the moving car, but he felt a knife tip in his ribs. So then the SUV heads out toward the bay where an Angler V-175 was waiting off Marina Green Drive. And they take him out in the boat, out onto the bay. And they speed out in the SUV in the motorboat. And somewhere out, slightly out of the bay, they switch to another boat. They get under the shadow of the Golden Gate Bridge. The sun threw a deeper chill into the boat, and the injured man realized they were going west. He stiffened more against that reality than against the wind. The area around his right eye was red and swollen. His left eye turned back to the horizon. They were heading toward another boat. When they reached the 38-foot Bertram, no hand offered to help the injured man climb out of the motorboat. He awkwardly leaned forward, propped himself on one palm, and half fell into the yacht. He realized they were waiting for him to enter the closed cabin of the Bertram. He did and sat. They followed him in but turned their faces away again. He saw himself looking across the counter at Maggie Hugh, wanting to slap her, to get her to listen and teach her respect. Every person commits mistakes throughout their lives. Most of them are small and instantly recognized as such. Those are actually the worst because they're fresh on the fingertips, still palpable but beyond reach. The grocery store was still vivid in his senses. The old wooden floors on which he had been standing, the smell of the fish. "You deserve whatever is coming," he thought. He had momentarily forgotten one of the guiding principles of their work. During 2 years of schooling, Jing Jintao had stressed the concept of renai, perfect patience, the marshalling of purpose, the veiling of the self, the anonymity they granted. That idea had been nudged aside by a sudden urgent desire to please his superior, to bend this woman to his will. And because of his impatient desires, the presence of Johnny Yu and the other two women had startled him, had made him afraid, had made him run. So he's in the boat now, and he doesn't know how long they've been traveling. Finally, they arrive somewhere. Two men grab him and pull him from the seat out of the cabin. His handkerchief slipped from his eye, and he saw the skyline of San Francisco in the distance. He smelled a musty scent, like that of a dog come in from the rain. He heard throaty clucking sounds and the splash of breakers. The men hoisted him up, and he turned, saw a raw, sharp, high outcropping of rock. There were elephant seals on the crags. "They're going to strand me here," he thought. The movement sent a series of drill-like shocks through his head, and yelping, he clapped a hand on his jaw to hold it still. When he could focus his thoughts, he felt a sense of gratitude that they were going to give him time to make peace with his actions. The man hit the water hard on his lower back. The impact folded him at the waist, his arms and legs shooting straight up as he went under. As he flipped, the pressure of the cold sea shocked his wound, causing him to scream a strange gurgling noise. His hands and knees came into contact with rough rock under the surface. He clawed at them until his face was above the surface. Through clogged ears, he heard the muted barking of the seals, smelled their fur, the decay of their meals, their waste. He flopped on the slick rock, cried out as sharp edges punched his chest, then slid his forearms under him. He panted as he rested there. Behind him, he heard the engine of the yacht still idling. He thought, "Why are they waiting to make certain I don't drown?" A wave caught him and shoved him roughly along the granite, scraping his chest. It was a strong breaker pushing him several meters. He was raw from neck to mid-waist, and his knee tingled. As his brain was processing the pain, and he realized he had to get up on the rock to keep from being buffeted again, He was dragged back into the water. The tickling sensation became a fiery ache, as though it were being yanked across a field of sharp stones. When his eyes opened, he was disoriented. He did not see the green-gray water moments before, but a murky red haze. It was joined by amber circles swimming around the edges of his eyes, by a flame that shot along the outside and inside of his left thigh, by a sudden intake of breath that filled his mouth with something foreign and metallic-tasting that stuffed his lungs with a sense of spongy discomfort. Located 27 miles from the Golden Gate, the uninhabited Farallon Islands are a nature preserve with a large seasonal seal and sea lion population that attracts great white sharks. The predators migrate there from as far away as Hawaii. Whales don't bother them. Killer whales don't deter them. The Farallon great whites feed well on mammal flesh and grow far beyond average, ranging from 13 to 19 feet in length. Gang members call the 141-acre wildlife refuge the pigsty, inspired by the Wild West practice of feeding murder victims to herds of pigs. Drawn to the man by the trickle of blood from his ear, the shark pulled him from the rocky ledge. The dying man's arms flailed spasmodically, involuntarily ticks as drowning and blood loss caused his body functions to shut down. He was gone up to the waist in the second bite, and all that remained after the third rending shallow, after the third were a few stringy shards of flesh, sinking bone fragments and pieces of fabric. Even the bloody handkerchief was consumed. In less than a minute, the shark had moved on. The occupants of the boat had watched without expression. One of the men got out with a rifle and pistol. The boat would return later with a tent, supplies, and a small runabout. Now that the mission was underway, it would be necessary to have someone stationed here full time. Anyway, that's the story thus far, and it leads back to San Francisco, to the DeYoung Museum. It's called A Time for War. And I want to reiterate a few other points about this Navy SEAL death and why I wrote the novel about it and how it's set in San Francisco. I would say this is probably the finest novel written with San Francisco as a background since Jack London. Now, many of you are spitting up your liberal stews and saying, why, that's preposterous. I haven't read that in the San Francisco Chronicle. None of the literary types in San Francisco have said that. Well, it is possible, though, that what I just said to you is the truth. Nobody has written a novel that better describes scenes in the San Francisco area, whether it be the Bay, the Farallons, the Nature Life, the DeYoung Museum, various and sundry scenes than I have in A Time for War. And yet, here's the trick. The book has never, ever been reviewed by the local phonies in the city. Doesn't matter to me. It matters to them that they're ashamed. They call themselves the San Francisco Chronicle, and yet they only chronicle the most fetid left-wing events of our time. They don't chronicle anything of value or of meaning that has anything to do with the political side of the aisle that they don't believe in. Doesn't matter to me. It matters to them. It's just like Obama. He's a politician, not a statesman. So what is the difference now that I've opened up the discussion on A Time for War, reading from my novel, between a politician and a statesman? Well, let's talk about it since Nelson Mandela is considered a statesman. A statesman is a man who is experienced in government, especially one who shows wisdom, diplomacy, and leadership in dealing with public foreign policy. A politician is a person who uses questionable means to attain power within a group. How do you like that one? You see the difference? See, in our nation's history, we've elected both statesmen and politicians. In the early days, we elected more statesmen and fewer politicians. Now we exclusively elect politicians and no statesmen. And that's why we are in trouble. Someone has said a politician thinks of the next election. A statesman thinks of the next generation. A statesman loves the Constitution. A politician hates the Constitution. A statesman's primary concern is to secure freedom for future generations. A politician's primary concern is to get elected or reelected. A statesman will not play politics with the people's money. A politician will buy votes with tax money. A statesman knows the people must control government. A politician believes that government should control people. A statesman knows that the people must limit government's power to tax. A politician believes government should have unlimited power to tax. A statesman gives his allegiance to the people and country. A politician gives his allegiance to government. A statesman will demand a balanced budget. A politician will spend money stolen from future generations. A statesman will cause peace. A politician will cause wars. In a few moments, we'll take quotes from a statesman Nelson Mandela, and compare to a politician, Barack Obama, right here on the Savage Nation. The phone number is 855-400-7282. Now, we could also talk about the state of South Africa before Nelson Mandela, during Nelson Mandela, and what's coming after Nelson Mandela. Because although the nation is in a state of, let us say, well, it depends upon who you are in South Africa. Because right now, things are good for some and bad for others. And I believe that after Mandela, things could go very, very bad. But remember, it was Nelson Mandela along with de Klerk who kept the peace in South Africa. It's also important for you to know that Nelson Mandela only served one term. He could have been basically the president of South Africa for life. Compare him with Obama, who seems to have no limits to his desires to hold on to power. Now, the statistics in South Africa are rather mixed. If you talk about crime from the perspective of what it could be, I would say, okay, well, it's not that bad. If, on the other hand, you live there and you're a white person and you're living behind concertina wire and 12-foot walls, you'll understand what I'm talking about. Can you blame anyone for that? You can blame anyone you want for that. You can blame the whites. You can blame the indigenous peoples of the area. Or you can blame the fact that that's just the way it is between when there's a power struggle. But my fear is that now that Nelson Mandela, the father of the country, is gone, it's possible that terrible things will happen because the new leader is not a Nelson Mandela. And I will come back to take your calls on the difference between Nelson Mandela and Barack Obama right here on the Savage Nation. If you want to comment on the Navy SEALs, 855-407-282. I'll be right back.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage.
We're talking about two unrelated topics. The death of the Navy SEALs aboard that old Chinook helicopter, which I basically memorialized in my novel, A Time for War, but it's set on a bigger canvas than that. And then comparing a statesman like Mandela with a politician like Obama, even though Mr. Obama is trying to cloak himself in Mandela's statesman-like record, he is anything but a statesman. We know that. In 1993, remember, Mandela and South African President F.W. de Klerk were jointly awarded the Nobel Peace Prize because of their efforts to dismantle the country's apartheid system. To have earned his Nobel Peace Prize, Mandela had directed a 20-year campaign of peaceful, primarily nonviolent defiance against the South African government and its racist policies. Mandela spent 27 years in prison after being arrested for his protests against apartheid. Now compare that with the 2009 Nobel Prize to Barack Obama. By the time Obama received his, the Nobel Prize had been watered down to the point where it's nothing more than a meaningless gesture in support of leftist, anti-democratic forces. Because Obama spent much of his time imprisoned by riding around in the cars of his friends, smoking pot and doing other sordid things. When he became an activist, Obama was a community organizer following in the corrupt path of the communist Saul Alinsky. Obama's work had, frankly, nothing to do with statesmanship, but all to do with accumulating power for his radical leftist buddies. Mandela's attitude toward racism can be summed up in his quote, "I hate race discrimination most intensely and in all its manifestations. I have fought it all during my life. I fight it now and will do so until the end of my days." In Dreams from My Father by Obama, he expressed his own rebellion with this quote, "When we ground out our cigarettes in the hallway carpet or set our stereo so loud that the walls began to shake, we were resisting bourgeois society's stifling conventions." Kind of a little different background. 855-400-7282. Now, let's not sanctify Nelson Mandela, because there are those who remember things that he did along the way. No one is perfect. He supported the PLO. He cursed Israel. He had a complicated legacy that Cuban exiles are not appreciative of, because the man saluted Fidel Castro's autocracy. In fact, Mandela lavished with praise Fidel Castro's dictatorship. So a Cuban by the name of Francis Martel wrote, Nelson Mandela was no saint. He was the exact opposite of a saint, the politician. In the words of Dave Weigel, he was no benign Muppety leader for much of his life. South Africans get to choose whether they will forgive Mandela's involvement in the African National Congress, a terrorist organization. They will choose whether they will sweep under the rug that Mandela believed, quote, that without violence there would be no way open to the African people to succeed in their struggle against the principle of white supremacy. Mandela, he writes, lent his name to a tyrant running his own kind of apartheid system, and the victims and families of Cuban exiles have a duty to their loved ones to speak up before the uncritical eye of the international media. An avid supporter of Fidel Castro, Nelson Mandela visited Havana in 1991 and praised the Cuban Revolution, quote, as a source of inspiration to all freedom-loving people. Castro responded with praise in kind, which I will not read. The fact of the matter is, that's a very bad, bad relationship there. But Mandela, he writes, did not stop at saying positive things about the regime. He insisted on telling its victims that he was choosing to ignore them. He wrote, who are they to call for the observance of human rights in Cuba, he said on his visit there in 1991. Who are they to teach us about human rights? Well, the Cubans think that they are the ones who have the right to talk about it, about the prisoners, their fathers and brothers and uncles who died in captivity, who spent even more time in Castro's hellhole dungeons than Mandela himself for opposing Castro's radical pivot to communism, which he promised his early supporters he would never turn to. Did you know that Castro said he would never be a communist? And his fellow revolutionaries who turned on him and said, wait a minute, you said you wouldn't be a communist, were thrown into dark, dank cells for up to 35 years? Did you know about this? Well, there's a lot more to any picture than meets the eye. And we'll talk about this when I return and who killed the SEALs and why right here on The Savage Nation.
Join The Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage. Warning, The Savage Nation contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised. And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation, home of borders, language, culture. And here he is, Michael Savage.
He was a pragmatic politician. He wasn't a visionary necessarily. He wasn't a philosopher. He wasn't a saint. But that, he never deviated from that. But anything that would get him there, he embraced, including violence, which he took the ANC, he created Umkhonto we Sizwe, the spear of the nation. He created the violent wing of the ANC. So, and people don't realize that and don't remember that. We've kind of made him into a Santa Claus. He wasn't. He was a revolutionary.
Well, we're talking about Nelson Mandela, the man, as opposed to the image. You know, it's like talking about George Washington and omitting certain things, or Thomas Jefferson or Ben Franklin. In this case, though, you're omitting an awful lot if you say Nelson Mandela was a Gandhi-like saint, because he wasn't Gandhi-like, and he wasn't a saint. He began as a heavyweight boxer, by the way. I don't know if you know that, which is very interesting. And he has more or less kept the peace in South Africa. However, there are real problems there, racially. And we're going to hear a lot about Nelson Mandela over the next few weeks, some true, some false. And I think it's worth talking about the difference between a reality and fantasy and the difference between a statesman and a politician. I think he was both, incidentally. Mr. Obama is neither a statesman nor a politician, incidentally. 855-400-7282. Let's take some calls. Martin is from South Africa. He's calling us from the state of Washington. Martin, go ahead, please.
Hi, Michael. Yeah, big fan. I just wanted to say a lot of people don't know that actually more people have died, white people have died since 94 than ever died during the apartheid regime.
No, wait, more black people have died as a result of what?
No, more white people have been murdered since 94 than ever died during the apartheid regime.
More white people have died or more black people have died?
More white people.
So what is the situation for white people in South Africa today?
It's pretty much living under some of the worst security stuff you can imagine. I mean, like you were saying earlier, it's, you know, 12-foot walls, wire fences, security guards, the whole deal. The figure is actually over 10,000 white people just this year. And you can look at the stats. I mean, vicious murders. It's the rape capital of the world. But what's happening there?
Is that true? I know that several years ago, Johannesburg was the infant rape capital of the world, and it's a statistic that's very embarrassing, but it needs to be talked about because the AIDS epidemic was and still may be out of control in South Africa, but the rape of infants was a big problem in South Africa, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. There was supposed to be a kind of a witch doctor thing that if you raped a infant, it was supposed to be cure you from AIDS. That was the big...
Oh! I didn't know that there was an actual reason behind the rape of infants.
The exact same thing that happened in Zimbabwe will happen in South Africa if it's not.
Do you fear that what's coming now is what happened on the Mugabe?
Exactly. It's a power grab, and nobody cares. You know, white people are just being slaughtered, especially farmers, in the most heinous. I mean, you couldn't even imagine how they've been murdered. It's disgusting. And you know,
but the leftists would say they deserve it because it wasn't their land. I mean, that's the leftist liturgy here. They say the white people don't belong in America. It belongs to the Mexicans and the Native Americans. They'd be happy to see the people slaughtered here.
Right. And you know, I was a Mandela fan. I still am. You know, he was a moderate leftist, but you know, he had his shortcomings, and he could have spoken out against this kind of thing, but he never really did as much as he could have. Especially the violence.
No, I mean, I know that South African whites have been leaving South Africa for 30 years now, if not more. Moving us out of the country. It's one of the most beautiful countries on earth, isn't it?
It is. It really is. And they've migrated to, you know, Australia and the UK and the US, anywhere that they could go. It's just, that's the other thing. It's kind of like a mind drain to all the, you know, doctors and, you know, lawyers and all that kind of thing. Why would they stay there? Because it's extreme reverse racism. You know, if you're white, you know, good luck getting a job. And especially on the farmer side, though, it's an absolute massacre.
Well, do you think that the farms will be appropriated by the state as it was done under Mugabe in Zimbabwe?
I think so. Eventually, if it gets to a point, and it's bad, it's to that point just about, but it's going to be worse. And the current president...
You know, people should know this about ex-Rhodesia. Zimbabwe used to be known as Rhodesia when it was a colony. And then the locals took it over. Mugabe seized power. And the whites were kicked off the farmlands because the black people said it was their land, and they took over the farming. What people don't know, it's another embarrassing fact for the universal internationalists. It's an embarrassing fact that makes people squirm. But under white rules, Zimbabwe had been a net exporter of food. They were able to export food to the world. After it was given to the local folks, they were unable to feed themselves. And they went out with a begging cup to the world because they couldn't feed themselves with the land that they had seized.
Right. And
so, you know, there's always another side to the story about colonialism and how bad it is and, you know, local control. I've heard all these stories, but people have to understand there's a reality. There's a reality as well. I thank you for the call. Now, look, it's an embarrassing discussion. And... people don't want to have it, and I know maybe I shouldn't even do it in my head. I'm not into the news. There's no news. This is a big story. Now, Nelson Mandela was a member of the ANC when he was elected South Africa's president in 1994. Now that he's died, the ANC is facing a struggling economy, a splintered identity, and life without this charismatic leader. Let us not forget the legacy of his ex-wife, Winnie Mandela, who punished her political enemies by putting burning rubber tires around their necks in an act called necklacing. Just remember what might happen. Just remember what might happen. And God only knows what might happen. But, you know, there is something that you should know. He embodied simple living. He respected constitutional term limits. And he respected a rigid respect for the rule of law. That is what made Nelson Mandela a statesman. Let me repeat it. And let's compare and contrast what I just said. Nelson Mandela embodied simple living. Does Obama embody simple living? No, the opposite is true. Nelson Mandela respected constitutional term limits. Does Obama respect constitutional term limits? We'll find out very soon. Nelson Mandela respected a rigid respect for the rule of law. Does Obama have a rigid respect for the rule of law? The exact opposite is true. And that is why he is judged with such disdain in the United States of America. What you hear now in Africa, they say, is will the new Africa, South Africa, be ruled by a Mugabe or by a new Mandela? I don't know. And we have to ask ourselves here in America, can we take 3 more years of the situation that we are living with? We're also talking about the Navy SEAL deaths, as eulogized in a way, or memorialized in my novel, A Time for War, 855-407-282. Why do you think the Navy SEALs were sent to their death? Or was it a pure accident? Were they simply shot down in a military action and we shouldn't even be talking about it? Texas Carol, KTBB, you're on the Savage Nation. Your opinion counts.
Dr. Savage, it is truly an honor to talk to you. My opinion is Osama bin Laden had renal failure 4 to 5 years before 9/11 even happened. My understanding is you really don't live very long with renal failure, especially if you're in a cave. I believe that he has been dead for years. He was used as a pretext to drag us into a war, this war against terror that is slowly being used and turned against the true patriots that are standing up for the Constitution. Because before, it was the men in the dirty nightshirts living in caves. And if you notice what's going on now, the Tea Parties are now being vilified. So I believe that Osama bin Laden has been dead for years, and that these Navy SEALs knew that, and they were the sacrificial lamb, because they were the only ones that actually, quote, unquote, saw and discarded his body.
Wow. Well, I don't think you're alone in that. I've seen it on the internet. But, of course, you know, conspiracy theories run rampant in a free society, and perhaps as they should. If we can still talk about who killed Kennedy, I think we can still talk about who killed the Navy SEALs, can't we? You know, that's an interesting statement that I just stumbled upon. America is still debating who killed Kennedy. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And yet there's not been a debate about who killed the Navy SEALs in that helicopter crash. This is an extraordinary event, Carol. When you lose that many SEALs at one time in one incident aboard one aircraft, you have to ask questions about it, don't you?
You'd be crazy not to.
Well, why is there no congressional investigation? Why? I don't understand it. Put all the cards on the table, put all the facts on the table. Why would they put on an aging, slow-moving Vietnam-era helicopter instead of fast attack helicopters divided into three? Normally, they're sent onto a mission in three fast helicopters. Instead, they were put on an old flying whale. Why? Anyway, these are the questions that need answering. 855-400-7282. By the way, whatever happened to that minimum wage strike yesterday? It's another one like the Million Man March that never happened. Remember that one in Washington? Oh, the Million Muslim March. Remember last spring? There were 12 people there. And yesterday we were told that 50 cities would be shut down, all of the fast food restaurants. I didn't see any strike, did you? It was another BS job by the unions and by the media. Nothing. By the way, on the minimum wage issue, which we've talked about, and I've worked for minimum wage, so I have sympathy for poor people. Do you realize if a government can set a minimum wage, they can set a maximum wage? Do you realize that? That's the danger of permitting a government to step into a federal minimum wage? Perhaps they'll set a federal maximum wage. I know that the liberal losers would like that. They think that anyone who makes above a certain amount is a thief or a crook. I guess it doesn't apply to people like Bono or the other leftist artists. They're allowed to earn any amount of money as long as they espouse leftist tripe. 855-407-282. Randy on WABC. Welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hello, Michael.
Yeah, Randy, yes. What's on your mind?
Yeah, well, there's no investigation about the seals because there's no accountability in our government. If a small, relatively small story like the seals is easy to cover up and sweep under the rug when something like Benghazi, which was headline news, is...
Yeah, you're right. You're a very, very, very... You see, you've got perspective there that I basically lost. Benghazi was actually bigger in some ways, and yet it's been because of the coordinated efforts of the government media complex, they've been able to sweep Benghazi under the rug. But, you know, let's ask ourselves, why am I focusing on the Navy SEALs deaths? Because when men of this caliber are all herded into a single old helicopter and suddenly die, you know something went wrong here. And you know that it may have been planned. You know that. So if this government is that demonic that they would kill Navy SEALs like that, they're capable of anything.
I believe that. And I also believe that the Founding Fathers realized this. And if I can quote them, when along...
Well, no, I don't want to hear about the blood renewing the roots. I can't go there. We can't go there. We're not into the revolution. You understand...
Well,
I have my limits on radio. You know, you can't call for revolution or violence, nor do I intend to. I am calling for investigation. What bothers me is that the Navy SEALs themselves are not marching outside the White House demanding an investigation. You know, there's an entire... How many retired special operatives do you think there are in this country? There are thousands of them. How many retired Delta Force, Navy SEALs, CIA, FBI, how many retired cops are there, ex-military who know what's going on? Why don't they stage a rally outside the White House demanding an investigation of this incident?
I guess because people on our side are not the kind to...
Because no one can organize them. No one's going to rent the buses. No one's going to organize it. We don't have the community organizer that we need. That's the one thing about the conservatives. We don't have a single community organizer. We may have some architects. I'm a good architect. I wrote the books that I by the way, when I wrote Trickle, the Poverty and Tyranny books, I said, consider me the architect of the future. I am not the activist. I'm the architect. But I don't know who the activist is. They haven't come along, have they?
No.
Maybe they built a dot-com company in Silicon Valley instead. Maybe they built a dot-com business instead of organizing for truth in America. Who knows? 855-407-282. I'll be right back.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now. 855-400-SAVAGE. 855-400-7282. Savage.
Over the coming months, we're going to continue our diplomacy with the goal of achieving a comprehensive solution that deals with the threat of Iran's nuclear weapons once and for all. And through it all, as always, our commitment to Israel and its security will remain ironclad and unshakable.
So there are the Jews, the stage Jews who were at the White House last night or the other night at a Hanukkah reception, and they applauded on cue when he said that he stands alongside and partner with the... Listen to clip one. The stage Jews applauded in clip one. Listen. Clip one, clip one, clip one, clip one.
We always need to keep working for peace and the freedom that we seek. And that's why we continue to stand up for our values around the world. That's why we stand alongside and partner with those allies who share those values, including the State of Israel. You know, together with our Israeli friends, we're determined to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
It's a complete lie. It's absolute propaganda. Iran has boasted themselves that they're going to continue to enrich and develop nuclear weapons. And the man gets away with it. The Jews sit there. The stooges. Where does he get so many stooges? A nation of stooges. I don't suspect I will be invited to the White House in the near future. The Iranian president himself said, are you kidding? We have the right to enrich uranium. Not one Jew stood up and said, Mr. President, you're wrong. The Iranians themselves said they have the right to enrich uranium. Where do they get such sellouts?
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-7282. Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. It's Friday, December 6, 2013. And the guys put together four pages of remarkable sound that I feel obligated to play for you because each one is a little gem unto itself. So let's start again with Obama at a Hanukkah reception at the White House with, like, Potemkin Jews applauding while he says the good things about Israel, even though everything is a lie. For example, listen to clip two.
We're testing whether it's possible through diplomacy to achieve that goal, understanding that we have to remain vigilant. You know, for the first time in a decade, we've halted the progress of Iran's nuclear program and key parts
of the program. There's the Potemkin Jews.
The program will be rolled back, even though the toughest of our sanctions remain in place, and that's good
for the world. Okay, he's a liar, because while Obama has presented the deal as a first step toward freezing or even rolling back aspects of Iran's nuclear program, the fact remains that so long as Iran is permitted to enrich uranium, which it is, right, it's free to produce as much fissile material as it wants whenever it wants. This is a roll forward, not a roll back. Secondly, Obama and Kerry lied when they said the New Deal does not recognize Iran's right to enrich uranium. They were immediately contradicted by Iranian president and senior negotiator, as well as the foreign Russian minister, Sergey Lavrov. So what is the truth? Well, we'll find out soon enough. We'll find out whether it's, you know, 12,000 degrees over Tel Aviv, God forbid, or 12,000 degrees over Tehran as a result of this wonderful appeasement. In clip four, Obama says Biden will go down in history as one of the best vice presidents ever. Clip four.
Yeah, I think Joe Biden will go down in history as one of the best vice presidents ever. And he has been with me at my side in every tough decision that I've made, from going after bin Laden to dealing with the health care issues to you name it. He's been there.
Well, in history as one of the best vice presidents ever. Well, from the perspective of China, that would be true. When the Chinese take over America and they rewrite the history books, Biden will go down in history as one of the best vice presidents ever. Because the fearless vice president, if you remember, just this week went to China to talk about the no-fly zone that they'd established. And he came back saying, we accept China's no-fly zone. So from the perspective of our Chinese currency masters, I guess he'll go down in Chinese history as one of the best vice presidents ever. On a more positive note, today the president lit the national Christmas tree. I'm sure that was a fun event for him. In clip five, let's listen to this.
Thank you so much. Is everybody a little wet but still having fun? Well, our main job today is to light the national Christmas tree, and so we're going to need a little help from you to count it down. We're going to start at five.
Yeah, let's do five.
Since it's a little wet, we shouldn't start at 10. All right, so everybody ready? Five, four, three, two, one.
Woo!
Oh, God help us. Everything's a reality show. Everything is a reality show. See, I could never be a politician. I suffer mood swings. I suffer from low blood sugar. I go into steep, dark depressions. The world's news is so horrible. How did they get up and do this? How did they get up and fake it like this? I'll never understand this. What is the impetus to drive people like this? I don't know this. I don't understand it. That's why I could never be in politics. It's, by the way, why I don't tour my show. I was speaking about that with one of my producers, and I said, you know, maybe with the new show I should do a 15-city tour. And then I realized I can't do it. Because I get enthusiastic thinking about it, but I hate traveling. The hotels, the bad food, the going on stage. But I would love to meet you, my audience. Because I was thinking about this. There are singers out there who haven't made a record in 30 years who still tour and do 30 dates a year. And they have a following. Think about it. Let's say they get 1,000 people in 30 cities once. You know, 30 cities, 1,000 people is 30,000. They don't need that much money to do it. They go out with the guitar. Or and the audience still loves it. There's an old singer whose name I forget. He's about 85 years old. Wherever he goes, he has an audience. He's never had a radio show. Leonard Cohen. I never heard him. I know that he was big in the 70s. It's like an alt, you know, like a grandfather type. 85, still goes around. The women still cry over him. I don't understand it, but it's a beautiful world in many ways to see old women 80 years old still think they're in love with him. So I'm thinking, you know, maybe in years from now, I'll be going and doing these tours. After, you know, years from now, 30-city tour. How could I survive a thing like that? It's impossible. It's just impossible. I'm so quirky. I need so many things in my life in order to get through a day. How could I ever travel? Don't fool yourself. I lived for years in the jungle, so if I need to, I could do anything. I'm a survivor at the end of the day. Okay, now let's move on with the sound. We'll skip Wrangle about Mandela. We'll skip the time edit to Stengel on Mandela. We played it. Oh, here's a scream. Oh, this is a lifesaver. This is like a lifesaver for a diabetic. What? This is definitely a lifesaver for a diabetic. What would the night be without the Bugs Bunny of American politics? Nancy Pelosi did one tonight that brought joy to all people who understand what true insanity is. When she said, extending unemployment benefits increases employment. This is what makes life beautiful, to realize we're living in a madhouse run by the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. Listen to clip 12.
Economists agree that unemployment benefits remain one of the best ways to grow the economy in a very immediate way. It immediately injects demand into our markets and increase employment.
So
for every dollar spent on unemployment benefits, the economy grows by, according to one estimate, $1.52, by others, $2. So
how
somewhere
is that? Wait, let me see if I could follow this. The smartest woman in San Francisco says that extending unemployment benefits increases employment. On the face of it, it's laughable. Now she says that for every dollar that we give people on unemployment, they spend $1.40. How is that? Where does the other 40 cents come from? Can anyone explain it to me? Is there a liberal communist psychotic out there who teaches at one of the dumb schools in America who can explain that to me? I don't understand it. Let's listen to her. She gets succumbed in the middle and mixes up a few ideas all at once. It must have been a low blood sugar moment. But let's hear clip 12 again and see if we can follow it.
Economists agree that unemployment benefits remain one of the best ways to grow the economy in a very immediate way. It immediately injects demand into our markets and increase employment. For every dollar spent on unemployment benefits, the economy grows by, according to one estimate, $1.52, by others, $2. So somewhere in that range.
First time I felt good all day. Neil, you just saved me with the Bugs Bunny music. That's wonderful. I finally feel good today. It'll justify my having several drinks tonight after the show. It's Friday. No, that's unbelievable. I never heard anything like this. I've never in my life, I've heard stupidity, madness, ludicrous lies. I've never heard anything that does anyone out there agree with Nancy Pelosi that for every dollar that we give people on unemployment, it grows the economy by $2 or $1.50. How does that work? Where does the extra dollar come from? I don't know, or 50 cents. She says that extending unemployment benefits increases employment. So let's hear clip 13 now.
Failing to extend the benefits will cost us 200,000 jobs over the next year, according to the Congressional Budget Office. We have a responsibility to American people. These are people who have played by the rules, have lost their jobs through no fault of their own, and need these benefits in order to survive.
Failing to extend the benefits will cost us 200,000 jobs over the... How? You give people unemployment insurance, and if you don't give it to them, it costs you 200,000 jobs? How? I would think that if you didn't give it to them, they'd go into the workplace and look for a job. Maybe the illegals could go home. All right, whatever. I had so much fun with the Bugs music. You can play the Bugs Bunny music now because here comes Leprechaun O'Reilly, who has become anything but conservative over the years, and it's worked for him very well. He's made a fortune by positioning himself in the middle, always wanting to work for the peacock, given that he likes loofahs. I think the loofah and the peacock would go well together. And he says that Mandela was a great man, but listen to clip 14.
Nelson Mandela, I've spent some time in South Africa. He was a communist, this man.
Yeah.
He was a communist, all right? But he was a great man. What he did for his people was stunning. The sacrifices that he made. He could have repudiated and got out of that prison. He wouldn't do it. He was a great man, but he was a communist.
Now, I don't know what this is, whether this is a product of loofing off too much outer skin over the years, where eventually it affects the neurons themselves, which then send a trigger reaction into the brain. I don't know how that works. He was trying to include a little too much all at once, but I love the Bugs music. And so we have to keep working on this theme of the Bugs Bunny music. In clip 18, Phil, get 18 ready. I'll call for it in a moment. Representative Matt Cartwright, Democrat from Pennsylvania, says people losing their insurance due to Obamacare is a good thing. So let's hear the Bugs Bunny music with clip 18, guys.
There's a reason you have minimum standards. There are people out there who have insurance who it's an illusion of coverage. I mean, they have immense deductibles. They have annual and lifetime caps. There's so many people out there with what I call phony insurance policies. And the fact that they're going to lose those policies sooner or later, I think is a good thing.
Can you believe who's representing Pennsylvania now? I mean, the best and brightest are either in prison or in the dot-com business. They left Pennsylvania to open up a dot-com business, or they got arrested trying to scam government money. Now we have the Bugs Bunny music as a background for Debbie. We have Saving the Best for Last. Debbie Wasserwoman Schultz. I affectionately changed her middle family name from Waterman to Waterwoman. Debbie Wasserwoman Schultz says that people will vote for us because we gave them health care. Listen to clip 21 with the Bugs music.
Those are critical benefits that, when compared to what the Republicans want to do, which is repeal or sabotage the Affordable Care Act and even shut down the government and hold the economy hostage in order to do it, that's the choice that voters will have. And I think voters will clearly choose our candidates who have been trying to give them quality, affordable.
If she were a relative of mine and there was a family dinner and she was at the dinner table, I'd probably set the tablecloth on fire with the Hanukkah candles and run out the door. I wouldn't be able to sit in the same room with this woman. Now we have Hillary Clinton on Mandela. I don't even want to play it because she's too serious. You can't even have fun with that one. It's just too serious. Although she did come out of the woodwork and start to speak. I just heard a chirp. Did we lose connection, Neil? I heard a chirp. That is the worst chirp a talk show can ever hear who works out of a remote studio. It's called the ISDN chirp. When you hear it, your heart stops. It's the equivalent of flying a 767 as the pilot, and you settle back, on a six-hour flight. You're 3.5 hours into it. You know that you're almost, halfway at the halfway point. Everything's been going well, and you're settling back, and you loosen your pants, and all of a sudden, the engine burps. That's what just happened. I'll be right back.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. Well, thank God I had some fun in the last segment. It was dragging. News has been so depressing out there. My God. You know what it is? It's the constant propaganda. There's not a scintilla of truth. And if you live for the truth and you don't hear any truth, you feel like you're going to starve to death. In a world of ersatz, everything's fraudulent, phony, staged. I feel like I'm living in a combination of the Manchurian Candidate and a stage play out of the ex-Soviet Union. Every day it's the same. It's getting worse. And even the Associated Press says we're living in the equivalent of a Soviet era, because they won't let anyone photograph the great man. The government puts out pictures of him to show you how bad it's getting. Well, whatever. Why complain about it? What are you going to do about it? It's just going to get much worse, far, far worse. 855, Pope Francis forms child abuse panel. Really? In the church? Well, that's kind of ironic. Front page New York Times, International A3, Pope forms child abuse panel. Pope Francis will establish a commission to advise him on protecting children from pedophile priests and on how to counsel victims. The Vatican said in what was a forthright acknowledgement of the enduring problem of abuse of priests in the Roman Catholic Church. It's unbelievable. That's unbelievable. That is unbelievable. You talk about, well, let it go with that. I mean, what can you say about that? 3% of the priests are allegedly child abusers or molesters, and yet they've turned it into the face of the whole church, and he's feeding into that propaganda of his own church. Let me repeat that in case you missed it. It's been estimated by reliable sources that only 3% of the priesthood engage in this vile behavior, right? And the rest of them are straight-up guys who have devoted their life to Christ and to helping people. And yet the new pope says he's going to focus on those 3%. It's astounding to me what left-wing visionaries do to institutions that they inhabit. Anyway, that's one man's opinion. Let's go to the callers. KLIF, Texas. Jen, you're on the Savage Nation. What's the topic?
Yes, Dr. Savage. So the topic is the comparisons that I've been listening to. Comparisons.
Between Mandela and Mr. Obama, yes.
And the one that I have not heard that is the most obvious to me, this non-comparison, is that Mandela was indeed a supreme uniter, uniting people. And Obama is the supreme divider.
Yes, it's true. I said that myself last night, and you're 100% right. A writer by the name of Joel B. Pollack wrote the top five ways Barack Obama is no Nelson Mandela. One, Mandela was a uniter, Obama is a divider. Mandela was not above playing racial politics, but generally did all he could to bring people together in both real and symbolic ways. Two, Mandela obeyed the Constitution and the courts, Obama flouts both. Three, Mandela was fiscally responsible, Obama is profligate. Mandela's administration adopted a policy of macroeconomic stability in 1995, putting sound budgets and economic growth before redistribution, resisting massive internal pressure to spend liberally on the poor. Four, Mandela reached out to the opposition. Obama ignores them. Five, Mandela was humble. Obama is arrogant. It's very well written, by the way. Very well written. I think it probably is. It's worth studying. I think that perhaps we should give this as a required reading during the funeral. South Africans share stories of seeing Mandela walking down the highway in his daily exercise or being greeted warmly. Mandela reached out to the opposition. Obama ignores them. Mandela fought pitched political battles first with F.W. de Klerk's National Party and then with Tony Leon's Centrist Democratic Party. Yet he reached out constantly to his opponents and met frequently with them. Obama, however, barely bothers to consult his opponents and makes a point of marginalizing them. And there is a difference between a statesman and a naked politician. So that's what we have right now. It's that simple. So I think it's worth talking about, and perhaps it'll be talked about again later on when the funeral comes up. Right now you can call me at 855-400-7282, WCOA Florida on the unemployment insurance. JP, thanks for calling. What's on your mind? JP, you're on the Savage Nation. Are you there? Gone with the wind. Plymouth, WCRN. Rita, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Well, somebody already said what I had to say about the SEALs, I think.
Okay, then we'll move on. I don't want to do the SEALs if it's been said, but I appreciate you listening so carefully. And so we've had a wonderful evening thus far in the Savage Nation. Some leave us after this hour. That music will now become a signature of any soundbite that I find to be particularly comedic. I used to like Bugs Bunny more than I liked Donald Duck in the theaters. I thought it was brilliant music. It typifies so many in our democratic machine.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage. Warning, the Savage Nation contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised. And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, the Savage Nation, home of borders, language, culture. And here he is, Michael Savage.
Well, tonight we're talking about statesmen versus politicians, and there's an awful lot that could be said about that, and it has been said. And we're comparing Nelson Mandela, who I consider a statesman, not a perfect man, but a statesman, while Obama is clearly a naked politician, and a particular breed of politician at that. It's been said that a statesman thinks about his country, while a politician thinks about himself. There are some great quotes around this, by the way, that are not directly related. And of course, we go back to John F. Kennedy. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Yeah, tell that to you-know-who. Mao Zedong, the butcher of China, said, politics is war carried out without bloodshed, while war is politics carried out with bloodshed. Abraham Lincoln, you can fool all of the people some of the time. You can even fool some of the people all the time. But you can't fool all of the people all of the time. Tell that to the president. Georges Pompidou was a French president, and he said, a statesman is a politician who places himself at the service of the nation. A politician is a statesman who places the nation at his service. Huh. Do you hear that one? That's a good one. We're continuing these great quotes. Lao Tzu said, failure is the foundation of success. Success is the lurking place of failure. Wow. Continuing on our quotations about statesmen versus politicians, Linda Lingle said, politicians all too often think about the next election. Statesmen think about the next generation. Socrates, who was killed by the Athenian government with hemlock, said, I was really too honest a man to be a politician and live. I guess we'll leave it at that for now on the Savage Nation, and go to michaelsavage.com and see some of the stories. Here's a sad one. What can I tell you? Spike in troop deaths in Afghanistan has been tied to stricter rules of engagement. No kidding. From the London Daily Mail, American men have started to talk like women. Did you know that? With the upswing at the end of a sentence? Mm-hmm. Obama approval down most among Hispanics in past year. Well, what does that mean? It means he didn't give them amnesty. Here's a big story. Illinois Democrat governor signs pension overhaul into law. This is a huge story. Two men spoke out against Obamacare and received IRS notices on the same day. What a government. Don't miss this sad story, horrible, frightening story of topless, swastika-bearing feminists attacking and beating up praying Catholics in South America. You're not going to believe who the new Nazis are, but I'm not surprised. I knew that when Hitler returned, he wouldn't be wearing a military uniform. The latest news now on michaelsavage.com continues. Well, there's good news economically. They say November unemployment is 7% with 203,000 new jobs, but 41% of the net new jobs were in government. And the private sector shrank in 41 states. And there's more people on disability than there are living in Greece. Okay, so who do you believe? They're jiggling with the data, right? Meanwhile, there's a cold chill across America, and the federal prison population has grown 27% in the last 10 years. That's terrible. That's really bad. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., 17% of marriages are homosexual marriages. How do you like that? Who would have thought that that's what they fought for in World War I, World War II, the Civil War, the Revolutionary War, the Vietnam War, the Korean War, the Afghan War, the Iraqi War? It was all done to make what? It's safe for gay weddings? Some would say that, yes. It's the mark of a great nation. Go figure. 855-407-282. Let's go to the first caller, a man named Ken, which is a pseudonym. He's calling us from Las Vegas on KBET. Ken, you're on the Savage Nation. What's your topic?
Hello, Dr. Savage. I'm calling, first of all, just I'm so excited to be on your show, and it's an honor to speak with you. And I'm excited that you are going to a new time just that more people can hear you. I'm a Christian, and I was born in Iran. And coming to this country, it was so exciting coming to this country 30 years ago. I remember you were reading a letter from somebody else that had come from another country a long time ago. I think it was from Russia or somewhere like that. And now he sees how this country is going down. And I feel exactly like that person 30 years
ago. But when you say you see the country going down, why don't you elucidate this concept for my audience? What do you fear is happening to America, having come from Iran, having fled Iran under the mullahs? What do you fear is happening here?
Yeah, first of all, I lived right before mullahs came. My parents, being a Christian, they knew Shah was in trouble, so mullahs were coming. So they tried to get me and my sister out first. So
they had foresight. They were like the Jewish families in the 30s who saw Hitler coming to power and got out while they still could get out.
That's correct. And but my parents later, they told me all kinds of stories, but because they were still there for a few years. As Christians, they could not even, like, I'll give you one example. If they went to the grocery store, like, to buy fruit, they were not allowed to touch the fruit because they were considered dirty. Anybody other than...
Oh, my God. Well, that's how Muslims treated Christians in Iran?
Exactly. Even though we were born...
But I thought that the Muslims were peaceful people. Obama said it's a religion of peace. I didn't know that they practiced any kind of prejudice against Christians. How do you like that? I didn't know that, Ken.
Oh, absolutely. And
I thought that all Muslims were lovers of peace and lovers of Christians and other religions. How do you like that? That's a shock. I'm just being sarcastic. You know that.
One thing that I need to clarify, like, most Muslims, they just want to live. It's not this government, but this government is an awful government. And it is amazing that somebody...
Oh, wait. Which government? You mean the Iranian government now or the government in America?
Well, actually, they both have become very similar now, unfortunately.
Well, that's what I'm asking you. What is the similarity between what you see emerging under Barack Obama and what you see in Iran? Where is there a similarity?
Well, the similarities are that people are just afraid. Are afraid of the...
Oh, now that's interesting. That's right. Obama has instilled fear in the average American. Which is what he wants. The man thrives on instilling fear in the American people.
Right, and well, what is the saddest part is when I came to this country, it was so exciting. I don't want to over dramatize it, but it's almost like going from hell to heaven. But now this country, now as bad as this country is getting, there is no place to run.
So why are so many liberals still in love with Obama? They still think they live in a perfect world. Why are they so in love with him?
Dr. Savage, you have this country correct. This country, I'm a pharmacist too. When you talk about drugs, it seems like the whole country is on drugs.
Thank you. That's correct. That is correct. I was told that 1 out of 5 Americans are on antidepressants, and I would say that's a low figure. I would say in the Marin County, San Francisco area, it's more like 5 out of 4 people are on antidepressants. They take a double dose every day because they walk around numb to the actual world they live in. They step over bums in the streets who are insulting their wives or girlfriends. They step over people who are fulminating with tuberculosis in the streets, and they say the homeless are victims. I see this with my own eyes, and I feel like I'm a man on a strange planet. 855-400-SAVAGE. Now, here's what I'm going to do. I'm reading from A Time for War by Michael Savage. It's a filibuster on my part until Congress holds an investigation of who put all those SEALs on that single helicopter. There's never been an investigation. It's a novel that came out last year. It's in paperback now. I wrote it. And it starts with the Navy SEAL helicopter going down in Afghanistan and all the SEALs dying. Remember, 38 SEALs were sent to their death in Afghanistan, and there's never been an investigation of who put them on that old Chinook helicopter. Not one investigation, because there's somebody covering up who did this. We don't know whether it was from the White House or the Defense Department. We don't know whether the SEALs were killed by an Afghani soldier aboard. Somebody set them up for death. Remember, this is the largest death of Navy SEALs in their history of their unit, all under Obama, and it's been swept under the rug. So I wrote a novel, a thriller, from the New York Times bestselling author, Abuse of Power, and radio host of The Savage Nation, comes a powerful new thriller. Let me read you the summary. A Chinook helicopter carrying a squad of Navy SEALs suddenly plummets to earth in Afghanistan. A car driven by FBI agents tailing a suspicious vehicle is mysteriously rendered immobile in San Francisco. The body of a Chinese agent is found floating miles from the Golden Gate Bridge after being fed to sharks. The U.S. is under secret attack and only Jack Hatfield, a popular TV host, hounded from his position by left-wing forces in the media for speaking the truth, suspects the danger of this lethal conspiracy. I'll be back in a moment to read from A Time for War as a filibuster against the Obama administration until they decide to hold a congressional investigation into the Navy SEAL deaths and an old Chinook helicopter. I'm Michael Savage. I'll be right back.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage.
I may get back to some of the news a little later. I don't know. I'm not in the mood for it. I mean, the Mandela story is basically over, except amongst politicians who are trying to capitalize on the man's statesmanship. They're all politicians, not statesmen. They're going to draw cover by going to the funeral. We know this. It's going to be 10 days of hiding behind his statesmanship and pretending that they're in the same category. But I don't want to do it. I'm just not in the mood. It's a Friday night. It's raining out here in the Bay Area. Yeah, we're on the verge of, the Christmas holidays. I listen to people. Their minds are on shopping, going on vacation, as you would be if you're a normal person. They don't care really much about politics. You may think that this is all a political show, but you're wrong. Remember, I made my reputation through news, views, and reviews, so don't expect me to sit here and hammer day and night about Obama. I'm not going to do it. But tonight is a political show. Even though I'm reading from A Time for War, I'm doing it for a political reason. I want an investigation. In a true democracy, there would be an investigation to see who in the Defense Department, who in the executive branch, put those SEALs on that old helicopter and sent them to their fiery death. Someone did this. It's unheard of. It's unheard of that the military itself is not screaming for this. Why are the SEALs themselves not saying anything? So before I go back to reading from my novel, I want to ask you a question. Who do you think, or why do you think, rather, the Navy SEALs were put on that helicopter and sent to their death? Ron on KSFO. Go ahead, please. You're the first up.
Hey, Mike. The reason why they were killed is to shut them up. It's very obvious to me that Osama bin Laden was not killed by SEAL Team 6, and these guys took the rap for it. Well, thank you so much for discussing it. I can't believe that you of all people are doing it. I'm so grateful to you for that. But for sure, they were killed because...
All right, well, something is wrong. It stinks to high heaven. It happened to SEAL Team 6 shortly after they allegedly killed Osama bin Laden. They were sent on a false flag mission, and they were all killed. And there's not been any congressional investigation. I'm demanding one. I'm only a citizen. So let me pick up in my story. It's my novel, A Time for War, Sausalito, California, headline, killing all 38 Navy SEALs on board. Jack Samuel Hatfield slapped off the alarm on his clock radio. The words hadn't quite registered as he blinked to clear his vision, trying to make out the luminous red numbers. He pushed the black hair from his high, strong forehead, dragged a hand across tired eyes. "You're late, champ," he smiled as Eddie bounded toward him from the foot of the queen-sized bed. The four-year-old gray poodle, all tongue and forepaws and big brown eyes, usually woke him up a minute or two before the 6 a.m. alarm. Jack dug his fingers behind the dog's ears, and Eddie drew back his head and jerked approvingly. Jack ended their morning ritual by pulling a well-worn chew toy from the drawer of his night table and flinging the toy to the floor. Eddie followed, landing on the rubber stake with a single mighty leap and a whimpering squeak from the stake. "Lie back and think of England," Jack told the chew toy. Then he groaned. He hadn't been awake 2 minutes and already England was back on his mind. Eddie had landed on the rubber stake like the full weight of Britain's blinkered bureaucracy had landed on Jack, who was still banned by the British Home Office from entering the United Kingdom, along with terrorists and criminals. Normally, it never crossed his mind, but he had a lead for a story he was writing on the smuggling of illegal Chinese medicines. The lead was in London, and London was off limits. Jack stood up, his body automatically adjusting to the gentle sway of the 40-ton Sea Rider. The cast-off bedsheet buried Eddie, who pulled his toy to safety and continued gnawing. Jack Hatfield, Jack thought, the defrocked talk show host, and the last truly independent journalist in America, hounded by the illiberal left and defamed worldwide, needs coffee. But he still headed to his office video editing station in the converted lower deck stateroom before he made it to the kitchen. He clicked on the radio and started going through his email. Prince William and the lovely Princess Kate will be touring. He turned off the radio. They probably spend 60 seconds on the Navy SEALs, he muttered, but they'll spend the full 5 minutes on the vacation plans of royalty. Every day, he wondered, was his profession dead now? How about now? News channels were afraid to report anything that their audiences might whine about, never mind topics that could scare them. Changing people's minds was serious, vital business, and nobody had the guts to do it anymore. Jack had received regular death threats when he was hosting his cable news talk show, Truth Tellers, but they had never discouraged him. Instead, it had taken all the resources of a giant to swat Jack down, back when he posed one simple rhetorical question to the panel on his former TV show. Quote, how would you feel if Muslim extremists got hold of a nuclear weapon? Within hours, MediaWire, the leftist radical watchdog group founded and funded by reclusive Austrian-born billionaire Lawrence Soren, had organized a smear campaign. They had been looking for a hook on which to hang Jack like a slaughtered bull. He was labeled an Islamophobe, and the liberals gleefully piled on with the kind of manic indignation only aging hippies and ignorant youth could muster. By the time Soren was done, Truth Tellers had not only lost half of its sponsors, but Jack was out of his job, and he was barred from the United Kingdom due to his, quote, radical and provocative statements, close quote, that were deemed a threat to public security. Eddie trotted into the office, the chew toy in his mouth. He laid down and sank his teeth into it. Now Jack was freelance, but San Francisco had been quiet for weeks. The most promising story was the smuggling. His phone rang. The caller ID said it was Max. I don't care if it's good or bad, he said into the phone, as long as it's news. It's one of yours, she said it, so it's news. Anyway, that's the story thus far, and it leads back to San Francisco, to the DeYoung Museum. It's called A Time for War. And I want to reiterate a few other points about this Navy SEAL death and why I wrote the novel about it and how it's set in San Francisco. I would say this is probably the finest novel written with San Francisco as a background since Jack London. Now, many of you are spitting up your liberal stews and saying, why, that's preposterous. I haven't read that in the San Francisco Chronicle. None of the literary types in San Francisco have said that. Well, it is possible, though, that what I just said to you is the truth.
Savage.
What a great, great time it is. And talk radio. I've done other things. I've had other careers. But when I entered talk radio in 1994, I have to tell you this, it wasn't long before I said to myself, I intend to be in the winner's circle. Now, it's taken me 20 years. It's only been two decades. And it's sort of the old Jackie Mason joke, which I'll never forget, which he did 20 years ago. You know, everyone heard of him. I had known him when I was a little boy, and he was a comedian in the terrible hotels, garbage hotels. I remember when he was thrown in the swimming pool. After his first performance, I was a little kid. I couldn't believe that. But this great comedian, Jackie Mason, came out when he did The World According to Me, I think, way back in 20 years ago, and he said, suddenly I'm an overnight success. They don't know it took me 20 years of working in toilets to get where I am. I thought it was one of the funniest lines I ever heard, but I feel the same way in talk radio, to be honest with you. I have no control over what's coming tomorrow. I don't know what could happen to me with regard to my career. I don't know. You know, I have a feeling I know. I know what's happening January 1st and 2nd, but I don't know beyond that. All I know is this. Everybody in talk radio wants to be on the Cumulus stations that I am on and I'm going to be on. Everybody knows that. They're the major platforms. They are the major platforms. WABC in New York. Who doesn't want to be on that? Who doesn't want to be on WLS in Chicago? Who doesn't want to be on WBAP in Dallas, KSFO in San Francisco? Who doesn't want to be on RKO in Boston? Who doesn't want to be on MAL in Washington? Who doesn't want to be on these great stations? Atlanta, KSEV Houston, JR in Detroit. WJR in Detroit is a station that everybody in radio has always wanted to be on. KVI Seattle, Michael Savage. I can go down the list. And there are many other incredible stations. I can't read them all. But I'm saying to you is that I'm going to be, first of all, I'm on most of them, but I'm going to be on most of them. And so what I do in radio is going to be a continuation of what I've done here at this time. And I remember, I'm running up against Fox News. I'm running up against 70 other radio stations. I'm running up against the internet. Do you know that when I started in radio, there was no internet? We had a thing called wires we had to read, AP wires, I think UPI. We had to look for stories. It was like a primitive teletype machine. We had to go buy newspapers and magazines to get articles to talk about. Now, that brings us back to today. You're still listening to me. You have ass outlets for news. You can go to the Drudge Report. You can go to so many incredible websites and in 2 seconds find out the headlines, and you could do it 10 times a day, and you do. So you don't need me or anyone else in radio to give you the news. You don't. So what are you listening for? You're listening for a unique perspective on events, the news events. Yeah, but is that all you want to hear? No, there's got to be something else. So there's got to be my dinner with Michael Savage. What did I have for lunch? If I tell you that whenever I go out in public, which is very rare these days, I become an almost total shut-in, people will see me in a crosswalk. I'll never forget these Filipino ladies. There were three of them in San Francisco, and I was in a crosswalk. And one of them honked to one and said, Mike, are you happy today? I want to find out how you're going to feel tonight on the radio so I can feel the same way. I thought that was amazing. So this is a personality-driven business. And if you hide your personality, well, you're defeating yourself. That is unless you're a miserable person. Now, if you're a miserable person, you better hide your personality and just talk about the Constitution and about Paul Revere. That's all I can say to you. But if, on the other hand, you're a likable person, as I can be, and I'm not necessarily always a likable person, I can be pretty ornery most of the time. But frankly, I think the best part of my nature comes out on this show, and I think you hear it. And I think it brings some levity to your life. I think it, I don't know, lifts you up, gives you hope, makes you feel better about yourself. I don't have an answer for it. All I know is thank God I'm still kicking, and thank God I'm still ticking. And I would have to say that this has to do with an awful lot of factors that have something to do with the spiritual realm. I know you don't want to hear it. You don't want me to go there. Most people are not religious. They don't believe in this. They think it's, you know, hokum. I don't. I'm not a formally religious person. I don't go to a house of worship. I've tried over my life. I've never felt comfortable in houses of worship. I've tried. I enjoy them. I think they're beautiful. I think the rituals are great. It just doesn't work for me because I'm not an organizational type of personality. I like to be alone. And with me, my relationship with the Creator is a kind of very personal thing. But what I'm getting at is, several times along the way, between when I began in 94 and now in the year 2014, coming up very soon, 20 years now, it's an awful long time in a career, but it was my third career, not my first. I want you to think about that. Most men would have retired and walked away and said enough is enough and done what they do. You know, you can mock retirement up to a point, but there's a certain beauty in doing nothing also. I developed a real skill in doing nothing many, many years ago. Before radio, I had read enough of Chinese poetry in English translation. I had read enough of Henry Miller. I had read enough of Lin Yutang to come to understand the joy of living and in doing nothing. I learned the joy of sitting in bed and reading a book. I learned the joy of drinking wine at night. I learned the joy of eating late instead of eating meat. I learned the joy of watching a passing cloud. I learned the joy of looking at a swooping bird. I learned the joy of lying on a rug and playing with a dog and so forth and so on. So believe me, it's not like I'd walk into a void if I didn't have radio. There will come a day if I'm still around and I'm not no longer working, I know how to do that. I was a writer for many years. And you know, in order to be a writer, you first have to know how to relax and relax your mind that there's nothing to write about. Unless you are open, unless your mind is open and your heart is open and your soul is open, you may as well not be a writer. Now you could write a hackneyed nonfiction book, which I've done. They're great books, but they're not the same as writing fiction. They're not the same as writing poetry. They're not the same as writing a song. They're not the same as writing a love letter. You have to have an open heart and an open mind. And I don't know how many people even understand that anymore. So what I'm saying is, this is almost an existential thing I'm about to tell you. I'm hoping for the best, but I'm prepared for the worst in 2014. Do you understand what I just said to you? I work very hard at what I do, but I make it very easy as well. I drive myself and the guys who work for me very hard from 8 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm up and I'm reading. Now, that's all going to change come January. It's going to be a different time frame. If I get up at 7 and my show is on at 6 o'clock at night, that's 11 hours later. But I've been working for those 11 hours for that show. Well, now I'm going to get up at 7, same time, and my show's at noon, going to be at noon on the West Coast. So it's a much more compressed time frame. I'm sure the guys that work for me can't wait. So you can have a half a day to do nothing. Because right now they are working hard. They're great guys. They love radio. They've been in it a long time. And they're dedicated to me. I'm optimistic. I don't know what might happen tomorrow. Let's put it to you that way. There are forces that are so powerful operating right now in the media and against the media that I don't know what might happen tomorrow. That's all I'm going to say right now. I want to talk about the pension story coming out of Detroit. It's probably as important a domestic story as any that has happened in many a year. Detroit ruling lifts a shield on pensions. You know what they're doing in Detroit, don't you? They could formally enter bankruptcy and asserted that Detroit's obligation to pay pensions in full was not inviolable, which means they could finally do what they had to do all along, which was what they should have done before bankruptcy, which is stop the pension pay. Take a look at the New York Times and you'll see some of the most beautiful structures America ever had. Michigan Central Station, the ballroom of the Lee Plaza Hotel, the St. Margaret Mary School. They are shells. They look like third world bombed out shells, all because the unions destroyed Detroit. Detroit was bankrupt because of the pensions. They couldn't pay them. And the judge ruled that Detroit's obligation to pay pensions in full was no longer a given. He said that public employee pensions were not protected in a federal Chapter 9 bankruptcy. That's even though the Michigan Constitution expressly protects them. Do you know this? This is an amazing story because what happened in Detroit, they say, in this ruling, is likely to resonate in Chicago, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, and many other American cities where the rising cost of pensions has been crowding out spending for public schools, police departments, and other services. So unlike the president, who says tax in order to fund the schools, tax in order to fund these other public services, Detroit has said we're taxed to death, we're cutting the pensions. This is what Obama should be doing. Now, this is a liberal city, Detroit. All Democrats, all liberals, and they understand reality. It's a shame that we have a federal government that isn't even as wise as that of Detroit. Can you believe this? Maybe it takes a disaster for them to wake up. Let's take some calls. WABC in New York City. Brad, welcome to the program. Go ahead, please.
What's up, Doc? I just had to say that.
Right. We'll get the Bugs Bunny music.
I was just curious. I never listened to Limbaugh. I'm aware who he is, but when you said that he's on a lower rated station now, was that because his ratings dived, or was it political pressure? And if it was political pressure, when you get to prime time, do you think you could be? I assume you would be next on the hit list.
Whoa! This question is such a loaded question. I thought I shouldn't even take it, but I didn't hear the question. Said you're on the air, but all right, I'll take the question. The answer is I don't know. I know that we're talking about Rush Limbaugh, who is the king of talk radio. He's been around longer than anybody. He opened the door to all of us, myself included. We have to remember that. However, having said that, it was announced that KFI in Los Angeles is taking him off that powerhouse signal and putting him on a marginal clear channel station somewhere in the hinterlands. That's an earthquake in radio. No matter how you spin that, that's an earthquake. And the answer is, to your question, I don't know, but I think it's a combination of both of the elements that you mentioned. Now, with regard to will I become a target in January when I am suddenly, in many ways, the heir apparent in talk radio? Now, remember, Rush and I are on opposite, not on the same time frame. And in fact, Rush Limbaugh is going to be on many of the same stations I'm on as my lead-in, incidentally. The answer is, I don't know. Be right back.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage.
I prepared all day to talk about the difference between a statesman and a politician, meaning, let us say, Mandela versus Obama, because there is a difference. So what is the difference now between a politician and a statesman? Well, let's talk about it, since Nelson Mandela is considered a statesman. A statesman is a man who is experienced in government, especially one who shows diplomacy and leadership in dealing with public foreign policy. A politician is a person who uses questionable means to attain power within a group. How do you like that one? You see the difference? See, in our nation's history, we've elected both statesmen and politicians. In the early days, we elected more statesmen and fewer politicians. Now we exclusively elect politicians and no statesmen. And that's why we are in trouble. Someone has said a politician thinks of the next election. A statesman thinks of the next generation. A statesman loves the Constitution. A politician hates the Constitution. A statesman's primary concern is to secure freedom for future generations. A politician's primary concern is to get elected or reelected. A statesman will not play politics with the people's money. A politician will buy votes with tax money. A statesman knows the people must control government. A politician believes that government should control people. A statesman knows that the people must limit government's power to tax. A politician believes government should have unlimited power to tax. A statesman gives his allegiance to the people and country. A politician gives his allegiance to government. A statesman will demand a balanced budget. A politician will spend money stolen from future generations. A statesman will cause peace. A politician will cause wars. The phone number is 855-400-7282. Now, we could also talk about the state of South Africa before Nelson Mandela, during Nelson Mandela, and what's coming after Nelson Mandela. Because although the nation is in a state of, let us say, well, it depends upon who you are in South Africa. Because right now, things are good for some and bad for others. And I believe that after Mandela, things could go very, very bad. But remember, it was Nelson Mandela along with de Klerk who kept the peace in South Africa. It's also important for you to know that Nelson Mandela only served one term. He could have been basically the president of South Africa for life. Compare him with Obama, who seems to have no limits to his desires to hold on to power. Now, the statistics in South Africa are rather mixed. If you talk about crime from the perspective of what it could be, I would say, okay, well, it's not that bad. If, on the other hand, you live there and you're a white person and you're living behind concertina wire and 12-foot walls, you'll understand what I'm talking about. Can you blame anyone for that? You can blame anyone you want for that. You can blame the whites. You can blame the indigenous peoples of the area. Or you can blame the fact that that's just the way it is between when there's a power struggle. But my fear is that now that Nelson Mandela, the father of the country, is gone, it's possible that terrible things will happen because the new leader is not a Nelson Mandela. And comparing a statesman like Mandela with a politician like Obama, even though Mr. Obama is trying to cloak himself in Mandela's statesman-like record, he is anything but a statesman. We know that. In 1993, remember, Mandela and South African President F.W. de Klerk were jointly awarded the Nobel Peace Prize because of their efforts to dismantle the country's apartheid system. To have earned his Nobel Peace Prize, Mandela had directed a 20-year campaign of peaceful, primarily nonviolent defiance against the South African government and its racist policies. Mandela spent 27 years in prison after being arrested for his protests against apartheid. Now compare that with the 2009 Nobel Prize to Barack Obama. By the time Obama received his, the Nobel Prize had been watered down to the point where it's nothing more than a meaningless gesture in support of leftist, anti-democratic forces. Because Obama spent much of his time imprisoned by riding around in the cars of his friends, smoking pot and doing other sordid things. When he became an activist, Obama was a community organizer following in the corrupt path of the communist Saul Alinsky. Obama's work had, frankly, nothing to do with statesmanship, but all to do with accumulating power for his radical leftist buddies. Mandela's attitude toward racism can be summed up in his quote, quote, "I hate race discrimination most intensely and in all its manifestations. I have fought it all during my life. I fight it now and will do so until the end of my days." In Dreams from My Father by Obama, he expressed his own rebellion with this quote. Quote, "When we ground out our cigarettes in the hallway carpet or set our stereo so loud that the walls began to shake, we were resisting bourgeois society's stifling conventions." Kind of a little different background. 855-400-7282. Now, let's not sanctify Nelson Mandela, because there are those who remember things that he did along the way. No one is perfect. He supported the PLO. He cursed Israel. He had a complicated legacy that Cuban exiles are not appreciative of, because the man saluted Fidel Castro's autocracy. In fact, Mandela lavished with praise Fidel Castro's dictatorship. So, a Cuban by the name of Francis Martel wrote, "Nelson Mandela was no saint. He was the exact opposite of a saint, a politician. In the words of Dave Weigel, he was no benign, muppety leader for much of his life. South Africans get to choose whether they will forgive Mandela's involvement in an African National Congress, a terrorist organization. They will choose whether they will sweep under the rug that Mandela believed, quote, that without violence there would be no way open to the African people to succeed in their struggle against the principle of white supremacy. Mandela, he writes, lent his name to a tyrant running his own kind of apartheid system, and the victims and families of Cuban exiles have a duty to their loved ones to speak up before the uncritical eye of the international media. An avid supporter of Fidel Castro, Nelson Mandela visited Havana in 1991 and praised the Cuban Revolution, quote, as a source of inspiration to all freedom-loving people. Castro responded with praise in kind, which I will not read. The fact of the matter is, that's a very bad, bad relationship there. But Mandela, he writes, did not stop at saying positive things about the regime. He insisted on telling its victims that he was choosing to ignore them. He wrote, who are they to call for the observance of human rights in Cuba? He said on his visit there in 1991. Who are they to teach us about human rights? Well, the Cubans think that they are the ones who have the right to talk about it, about the prisoners, their fathers and brothers and uncles who died in captivity, who spent even more time in Castro's hellhole dungeons than Mandela himself for opposing Castro's radical pivot to communism, which he promised his early supporters he would never turn to.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-7282. Savage.